this will be going on over the next 2 weeks. It'll be the highest level of sanctions by the time it's finished over a two-week period.
More pressure is aimed at North Korea. It's Wednesday, November 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Cambodian fishing at risk, Harvard under scrutiny about Asian students, Australia looking at youth detention standards, monitoring your health, hydrogen-powered cars. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korea and Japan Tuesday welcomed the United States announcement that it was putting North Korea back on its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a move, a South Korean foreign ministry spokesman said, is part of the international effort to denuclearize Pyongyang peacefully. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman described the situation as complicated and sensitive and called on all parties to return to the correct path of negotiation, dialogue, and consultation. President Donald Trump, in making the announcement from the White House, said reinstating North Korea on the list after being removed in 2008 should have been done a long time ago.
In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. This designation will impose further sanctions and penalties on North Korea and related persons, and supports our maximum pressure campaign to isolate the murderous regime that you've all been reading about and in some cases writing about. Tomorrow, the Treasury Department will be announcing an additional sanction and a very large one on North Korea, and this will be going on over the next 2 weeks. It'll be the highest level of sanctions by the time it's finished over a two-week period. The North Korean regime must be lawful. It must end its unlawful nuclear and ballistic missile development, and cease all support for international terrorism, which it is not doing.
The North was first put on the terrorism list following the downing of a Korean Air passenger jet in 1987 with the loss of 115 lives. It was taken off by the Bush administration as the North began implementing a nuclear disarmament agreement. Critics contend it will only incite North Korea to engage in a provocative behavior, undercut efforts to get China's cooperation in reining in Pyongyang, and do little to encourage dialogue. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Tufts University Assistant Professor of Korean Studies, Sung-Yoon Lee, if he believes it's a good move.
Yes, because there's been a very strong movement within Congress to get the administration to relist North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. You know, Trump's announcement during this week of a major holiday in the United States with Thanksgiving Day just looming, it gives North Korea the excuse to conduct another major weapons test and then to deflect blame onto the United States, to do something North Korea would have done anyway and lay the blame on the U.S. North Korea will say this is a provocation, it's unacceptable. But the question is, does this act have beyond symbolic opprobrium? Does it have real practical financial costs? And I would say decidedly yes.
So there is an upside to this argument?
Yes, there is. First of all, North Korea never should have been taken off the list when it was during the Bush administration in 2008. That removal of North Korea from the list was in return for Pyongyang's illusory promise of denuclearization and full compliance with inspections requirements. We know none of that has come into fruition. What are the practical benefits of relisting North Korea? Well, from now, any bank that seeks to process dollar transactions using U.S. dollar denominations on behalf of a North Korean entity is now required to apply for a Treasury Department license. It adds an added layer of deterrence, whereas before the relisting, a bank that may be suspicious that this is a shady deal with North Korea will most likely blithely just go on and do it, ignore it, and will probably be able to fly under the radar. Now, if a bank is found to have willfully violated U.S. laws, then conceivably the United States will at some point levy a major fine on that bank on the scale of BNP Paribas, the biggest French bank, which was fined almost $9 billion for violating this kind of general licensing requirements with respect to Iran, Sudan, and Cuba. So, you know, it's not merely symbolic. It has real financial costs on North Korea's business partners. Moreover, any public corporation that has investments in North Korea are now required to disclose their investments in public filings. What does that do? Probably not much in the short term, but since there is so much attention, world opinion and attention on North Korea today, it's not inconceivable that you might see movements toward divestiture from those companies. Where would we see that kind of movement? Well, on college campuses, within NGOs, because we saw exactly that with respect to South Africa and apartheid.
Sung-Yun Lee said the relisting of Pyongyang will make Chinese banks and state-owned enterprises more careful and circumspect in their business dealings with North Korea. Chinese envoy Sung Tao ended a four-day trip to North Korea Monday, a visit some thought might include a stern warning from President Xi Jinping over nuclear tensions. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi hopes for Rohingya agreement with Bangladesh. Pakistan welcomes U.S. offer to prevent militant raids from Afghanistan. China sentences rights lawyer to 2 years in prison. International Criminal Court prosecutor requests probe for alleged misconduct in Afghanistan. Delhi's homeless most affected by severe air pollution. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Cambodia's Tonle Sap Lake, which lies in the center of the country, is home to hundreds of species of fish that provide the Southeast Asian nation with up to 60% of its protein. But the lake's rich fishery is at risk because of overfishing, pollution, and hydroelectric dams. VOA's Amy Katz narrates this report by Kevin Enix.
The Tonle Sap is a seasonal freshwater lake that shrinks and grows by thousands of kilometers with the seasons. It is home to hundreds of species of fish and yields as much as 300,000 tons of fish every year. But that is changing.
In the past, we would catch lots of fish using our nets, but now there are so many people fishing here that we are not catching much anymore. That means we are making far less fish paste than before. Yes, and now the water level is high again, but it smells really bad, and as I said, there is not as much fish as before.
The reasons why are common to many of the world's bodies of water. Overfishing is reducing fish stock, spawning grounds are disappearing, and hydroelectric dams stopping the natural migration of some fish species. And the problem could get worse.
There are plans to build more dams upstream in Laos. In Cambodia, we already have a dam. We are worried the electric dams will affect the fish migration and reproduction rates. The dams have also slowed down the rate of water flowing into the lake and affect the water quality in the Mekong River.
The problem is twofold, because not only are there fewer fish to feed Cambodians, but there are more people relying on fishing to make their living. And the lake is dying. In 2016, environmental groups named Tonle Sap the world's most threatened lake. Government agencies say they are doing what they can.
We are continuing to work with the fishermen in the region to try to fix the problems. We've had many meetings with the parties. Just this morning, we filed our latest report with the Ministry of Environment, and soon they will be discussing with us what we should do.
The fear is not only will there not be enough food, but in coming years, smaller catches will cause a migration crisis as thousands of people who make their living on the lake head to cities looking for work. For Kevin Enix, Amy Katz, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi expressed hope Tuesday for reaching an agreement with Bangladesh on the return of Rohingya Muslims who have fled to Bangladesh in the past 3 months. She said work is progressing on a memorandum of understanding for the refugees' quote, safe and voluntary return. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us today. The U.S. Justice Department has threatened to sue Harvard University to force it to turn over documents as it investigates whether the Ivy League school's admission policies violate civil rights laws by discriminating against Asian American applicants. We hear more from VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
The Justice Department is probing the school's compliance with Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that according to a letter seen by several news organizations setting a December 1st deadline for Harvard to hand over documents on its admission policies. The Justice Department cited a 2015 lawsuit that charges Harvard's affirmative action policies that they do discriminate against Asian American applicants. Joining us is Ilya Shapiro, a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Washington-based Cato Institute. Ilya, thanks for joining us. How do Harvard's admission policies discriminate against Asian Americans?
Well, we don't know exactly, which is part of the problem. The lawsuits that were filed by an organization called Students for Fair Admissions in 3 years ago, November 2014, talk about statistical evidence that suggests that there's racial quotas or an attempt in any event to limit the number of Asians that are admitted, people of a similar academic qualification, you have to be many more times qualified if you're Asian versus if you're white, and then if you're Latino, black, there are different rates based on different races. But we just don't know whether Harvard's method of getting to that strange result, what it is. It's a black box, and so there's been an attempt by that lawsuit and now by the Justice Department at getting information at exactly how Harvard uses race, because the Supreme Court has said there are ways of doing it that's constitutional and there are ways of doing it that are not.
Well, the school has maintained for a long time now that its admission policies are fully compliant with U.S. laws, and they've worked to increase the amount of financial aid it offers to ensure economic as well as racial diversity in its classes. That's not enough?
Well, assurances are nice, but I'll trust Harvard about as far as I can throw it. And I don't just say that because I went to a different Ivy League institution, but the history of Harvard has had quotas, racial quotas, ethnic quotas of various kinds over the years. And so as the Asian American population in America has grown and the caliber and quality of student applicants has increased, we haven't seen a change over decades in any of the Ivy League schools, frankly, even if we have seen growth in California and certain other very good and selective institutions. So we really won't know until the documents come out, either to the Justice Department or in this litigation. But simple assurances are not enough, and the Supreme Court has said so.
There is a stereotype of the Asian and Asian American student because of their background and the way they were raised turning out to be better students. Now, does that factor into this as well?
Yes, those kinds of Asian stereotypes that people are only into math and science and maybe play a musical instrument, but that's about it, and they all go on to become doctors or maybe scientists, that is the stereotype. I think that's a form of, like all stereotypes, when you're judging individuals against them, I think it's unfair and it can be racially discriminatory. So I would hope that's not what Harvard is doing, but who knows how exactly that works. It's just curious that in the last 25 years, as American populations have changed and Asian American populations have grown significantly, the percentage of Asian Americans at all Ivy League schools has stayed about the same, even as at a place like Caltech or Berkeley in California, they've grown significantly.
Well, we have tried to contact both the Department of Justice and Harvard for reactions, and they have not replied to our request. What would your headline be on this?
I think there's a lot of misinformation about what affirmative action is. A lot of people think that all it is that if you have two equally qualified candidates, okay, let's give the nod to the historically disadvantaged minority or something like that. But it's just not. The types of advantages that are being given purely on race, not any other characteristic at all, is astonishing. It's generally in these highly selective schools worth more than being a violin virtuoso or Olympic athlete or things like this. And that's a conversation that we should be having about who exactly benefits from these sorts of racial preferences.
Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, also editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Ilya, thanks so much for trying to clear this up for us.
My pleasure. Take care.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A court in China's southern Hunan province has sentenced prominent rights lawyer Jiang Tianyong to 2 years in prison on the charge of inciting state subversion. Jiang is the 12th lawyer to be sentenced since China began a sweeping crackdown more than 2 years ago. See and share top stories and great features at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, an inquiry in Australia is recommending the closure of a youth detention center involved in an abuse scandal that shocked the nation. Images of inmates being mistreated, including one teenage boy who was restrained and placed in a spit hood, were shown last year. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Last year, a TV documentary showed images of young detainees being tear-gassed and strip-searched in youth detention facilities in Australia's Northern Territory. The scandal prompted the authorities to set up a Royal Commission, the highest form of inquiry in Australia. Its final report contains more than 2,500 pages and demands sweeping changes to address the shocking and systemic failures in the territory's youth justice system. A teenage detainee told the investigating team that he'd been deprived of food, repeatedly strip-searched, and stopped from using a toilet during his detention. He said he was forced to defecate into a pillowcase. The report said that the system's failures had happened over many years and were known and ignored at the highest levels. Northern Territory Chief Minister Michael Gunner is promising to act on the proposals.
I am sorry of the stories that will live on in those children who are in our care, children that we have failed, because our youth justice and child protection systems are supposed to make our kids better, not break them.
The report calls for an end to detention for children aged under 14 in the Northern Territory, prohibiting the use of tear gas and force on child inmates, and a move away from punishment to therapy and rehabilitation. The Northern Territory's notorious Don Dale Youth Detention Centre, where much of the mistreatment of child inmates took place, should also be closed, the report says. Margaret White, one of the commissioners, says more humane alternative accommodation should take its place.
The point must be met that there will be some young people who must be kept in secure detention, either because of the extreme seriousness of the crimes that they commit or because of their own complex needs. And we've recommended a small, secure facility. We don't want any more than 12 beds in any one facility.
Most of the teenage inmates in the Northern Territory are Aboriginal Australians, who are significantly overrepresented in the justice system. The children who were tear-gassed have said they feared for their lives and still suffer disturbing flashbacks and nightmares. Lawyers said detaining children in isolation was also a clear violation of the United Nations Convention Against Torture. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia. SoftBank's planned investment in Uber could result in a consolidation of Asian ride-hailing businesses, according to sources following the industry. SoftBank is a major investor in Uber's Asian rivals, including Grab, Didi Chongqing, and Ola. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, another wearable health monitor is poised to enter the market. As VOA's Faith Lapidus reports, this one is on permanent watch for any signs of illness.
This may look like an ordinary watch, but it's not. The MAP Health Watch uses artificial intelligence, or AI, to constantly analyze the health of its wearer, offering an early warning system for medical emergencies.
There are clinical-grade, highly accurate sensors involved in this watch. There are five of them, which are determining vital signals and calculating other non-diagnostic parameters.
The sensors continually measure vital signs like blood pressure, heart rate, and skin temperature. The data is sent to the MAP Health Watch team to be evaluated by the AI and the medical staff. With a constant stream of data, the analysis should get better over time.
The longer the person wears this watch, the longer the time the watch can adapt to its user, then the better alarm signals and less amount of false alarms and more specific alarms will be generated.
Five prototype watches are undergoing tests before mass production starts in China, and medical teams will be set up in the U.S. and Hungary. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
When it comes to powering cars, generally there are three options. There's gas, a gas battery hybrid, or a full electric car. But for a fourth option, some car companies are now banking on hydrogen as the fuel of the future. VOA's Kevin Enix powers this report.
Toyota has been selling the Mirai since 2014. The car giant has only sold about 4,000 of these hydrogen fuel cell-powered cars. But Toyota's chairman is convinced the fuel cell will be the technology that drives tomorrow's emission-free vehicles.
There are two main points we need to consider. First, how to realize a low-carbon society to create a society with less CO2 emissions. The second point is to ensure a stable energy supply for the future. In this light, hydrogen holds tremendous potential.
A fuel cell mixes hydrogen with the oxygen in the air to generate electricity that can power a motor. There is no exhaust gas. The only byproducts are electricity, heat, and water.
Hydrogen certainly has more convenience for users than electric cars. The driving range is longer, and it takes the same amount of time to fill up with hydrogen as it does to fill up with gasoline cars.
More convenient in theory, but in fact, there were only a handful of hydrogen gas stations in the United States, and they are much more expensive than electric or hybrid automobiles.
It seems possible that if it could be streamlined into a more affordable and mass-producible technology, then it might be able to catch on. But it's hard to say because our society is so deeply entrenched in what we already know, which is, you know, gasoline and electric.
Toyota says it wants to sell 30,000 hydrogen-powered cars a year by 2020. Its ultimate goal is to cut car emissions by 90% compared to 2010 levels by 2050. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to say hello to everyone listening on the radio in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Helps Radio at Help University. Thanks so much for tuning in today. You can also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, which is a great place to send us a message. Why don't you go online and do that? Or you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you and find out what you're up to in your part of the world. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Dave Magnus, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.